All right, bro. You ready? Yes, I'm excited for this one. So why don't you give me a quick intro, and then we're just going to roll right from there.
So my name is Jeremiah Wilbur. Retired from the Army. I spent 20 years in the military. And now I run an organization called War Party Movement, as well as I'm the co-founder of War Party Ranch, which is a 501c3. We work with female survivors of abuse to empower them through just kind of badass skills, horsemanship, hunting, self-defense, shooting, and really just kind of give them some things in their back pocket to empower them and help them move forward with life. So
I can't wait to get into this, because this is something that, like we were just talking about, my wife and I, you know, looking, and we've been watching and seeing what's been going on in our own country, and it's pretty crazy. But let's get right into your childhood. I'll start from there, because you're a fascinating person. we got to spend the night last night. So where'd you grow up?
So I kind of grew up all over Montana to begin with. My mother is Apache. She's Muscular Apache by blood, but she a lot of people don't know about the Native American boarding schools.
Okay.
So my my grandparents both went to residential boarding schools, and they were kind of whitewashed, if you will, but in this sense, more brownwashed. Like, they changed their last name to Cordova. They basically kind of inculcated in the Mexican culture.
Really?
Yeah. So my mother was raised more like a Mexican, and even though they're Native, they still did a lot of Native traditions, a lot of Apache things, but it was like, my grandmother spoke Spanish, you know, like she... And she didn't want her kids to have to go through what she went through, so she moved to outside San Diego, in the mountains of San Diego.
Was this a program created by the government?
Yes, absolutely.
So that was to pretty much take the culture out of the culture?
Right, so the statement, I forget the general that did it, but there, like, you can literally look it up, he says, like, we want to educate the Indian out of the man, or vice versa, however it went.
I've heard a statement like this before.
Correct. So, you know, in our country, it was until like 1976, I believe, is the year that we had Native American boarding schools. Canada had them until like 1996.
Really?
Yeah, they're really bad. So a lot of the stuff you'll see in the Native community talks specifically about residential boarding schools, because every family was affected. So, like, my story isn't an uncommon story for people who are raised outside of their culture, especially people that have, you know, mixed race, you know, or... you know, military family or whatever, and a lot of Native serve in the military, and that's kind of my family story and like how it you know, progresses through, like, you know, the rest of my childhood and the rest of my life. So my grandmother moves to California, Southern California. Actually, really cool community, because it's surrounded by like five Indian reservations, you know. So
where at?
Out in San Diego County in Julian, outside of
Julian. Okay, so I was in Temecula.
Oh, right. Yeah. So right.
Pechanga and everywhere. Yep. I know all that area.
So I was actually born in San Diego. My dad's family was also from San Diego. They were, like old school vaquero cowboys. Then my grandparents moved to Montana in like the '70s. So that's kind of how, my family ends up getting to Montana.
You guys followed suit.
Well, I think I was just born in San Diego. I don't know if my mom were like, I don't know the whole story, if I was there visiting or what was going on. So anyway, we live in, you know, Montana until I was, what grade? Like 7th or 8th grade, I believe. Mm-hmm. And all over Montana, my dad was just like a blue-collar guy starting out. He was just a cowboy working on ranches and whatnot. And then we lived everywhere from like Ennis, Montana, to up on the High Line, up by Haver, in the Rez, lived in Great Falls. So we kind of bounced around. And the reason why we bounced around towards the end was my dad put himself through nursing school, and he wanted to be a flight nurse.
Really? Good for him.
Yeah, so he changed his, like, this trajectory of, you know, just blue-collar, like, just cowboy stuff, guide hunting, you know, guiding elk hunts and just chasing that life, and was like, there's no money in it, you know? Like, we literally lived in, like, a one-bedroom cabin, like, you know, at times. And but I had an amazing childhood because of all those things, because of, like, you know, always being outside and just working and being in Montana, where it was like, you know, I'm going to the ranch with my dad. I'm working. I'm going hunting. I'm from like the youngest ages I can remember, you know.
Yeah.
my mother was also not famous, but there's a couple like really famous Western artists, like Vail Miller is one of them, and Putt Putman. My mother modeled a lot for them. So a lot of the postcards that you see with Native women that are older ones, there a lot of them are my mother.
Really?
Yeah. And I remember a lot of that, because they would do, like, those guys did, like, reenactment scenes. So they would have, like, a mountain man, with like my mom on a horse, you know, and like her like in like a jingle dress or like an elk dress, like a tooth dress. So all these different, like she would wear like her traditional stuff, and then, yeah, you know. So in that time as well, my mother and my father both get, but most of my mother, she meets this guy named Harris Rock, and it becomes like a grandfather to me, and he adopts her into the Assiniboine tribe, because my mother didn't grow up with like a bunch of these traditions and stuff because of the boarding school system. So when I tell people, yes, I'm Native, I would love to try to connect more with my Apache side and learn more, you know. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it is really cool to have all these, like, I grew up like an Assiniboine kid, with traditions and the powwows and everything we went to, yeah, and everything we did. It was like, I didn't even know I was an Apache or I wasn't Assiniboine until I was older. And my mother was like telling me what was going on. And even my mother didn't really know the whole story of boarding schools and like everything that happened. My grandmother was very ashamed of it.
Because they didn't know even they. I mean, technically, in a way, it was a brainwashing program.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was.
They didn't know. I mean, they were washing the culture,
correct,
out of our, yeah, country, or trying to, at least.
When you look at it from a, I don't know what the right word would be, but like when you come back and you look at it from like that 10,000 foot view, right? Mm-hmm. You have one of the most, not every tribe, not all, but people don't understand how to differentiate between Indians, right, or natives. So if you're, as the Western Front begins to move from, you know, where it was back east, mm-hmm, and continues to push west, it just gets more hostile and more hostile and more hostile. And then especially once you enter, you know, Oklahoma, Texas, like the plains and the Western states, they encounter some of the greatest warriors the planet's ever seen. Mm-hmm. So now you're looking at this fiercely gruesome fighting force that no one understands. They don't speak your language. They don't act like you. You think you're this advanced person because you know, wear different clothes than them and you speak a different language. Mm-hmm. So you think they're not advanced. So you had all this like going on with the government side. And then, you know, if you're, it's one of those things like Americans can do it any country they go to, right? Like you think like everyone is the same from that country, and you get there and like, oh, they're different too. Yeah. Like Americans, yeah, yeah. And some countries aren't that way, right? Some people are like, dang, everyone's white here. Everyone speaks the same language.
Right.
Or whatever, you know? So I think when you look at that as a whole, there was a lot to do with that on like a defense strategy to like, how do we, you know, basically indoctrinate them, change their culture, their way of life. And you do it with the kids. So we change the kids, we force them to go to these schools. Now the kids can't communicate with their parents. They don't follow traditions. They have to cut their hair. They can't speak their language. We're removing every piece of identity of them being Indian out of them, to include the warrior, because if we take away that, they're not going to be warriors. Mm-hmm. So that's basically kind of like, in my mind, that would be like what the government, or what like kind of white, you know, the umbrella of the government at that time is. And at the same time, it's also like, when you fast forward to what's going on now, it's why a lot of people, I wish people would use the Native example more, right? Because when you look at Indian reservations, especially the ones in the West, they're in the middle of nowhere. You know, we actually have data, people, my people, that if you remove everything they want to do in life, their way of life, the way they think, what the food they're allowed to eat, everything, and force them to live somewhere, look at what happens to them. Now, obesity is rampant. You know, addiction is crazy.
Alcohol.
You name the alcohol, you name the addiction. You know, missing women, missing, you know, domestic violence, like every single problem you can think of is just exacerbated, as well as there's zero jobs. So it's not like, you know, my example is always like Amazon's not going to build a warehouse outside the Crow Res in Harding.
Yep.
It's not. So what do you expect them to do? So I wish more Americans would see that model and understand what happened, mm-hmm, and look at this as a whole of like, if they did that, right? And people were like, well, it's like, yes and no. It's not because they look different, you know. Like now we're seeing that with the way people think, right? Like if you think differently than me, then I can, you know, we want to suppress this or force these thoughts or do these things. And this is a very slippery slope. And we have an example what happens to people when you do that to them, you know. And even the big ones, food's a big one. You know, like a lot of obesity is very big in the Native community, and that's what happens when you just force commodity foods on people. For sure. That were primarily, you know, carnivore. Hunter-gatherer diet until 150 years ago, you know, and even Indians that live in like down Arizona, like Maricopa, Indians there live on the river and they're farming and doing things. But even then, I think people get that don't hunt and don't see what an animal produces. They get misconstrued that everyone's like this amazing hunter and it's going to feed people. But it's like, dude, if we shoot one elk and we have a village of 50, like we all get a little piece of meat tonight and that's it.
Yeah.
And most people don't, you know, they can't understand that. So I think the how drastic it was and what we removed from the Indians is it's way, the value in that and the weight in that is a lot heavier than you can really imagine, because most Americans, regardless of your color, your skin color, unless you are, you know, very inundated in your culture, mm-hmm. you're from another country, you're second generation, you know, immigrant or something like that, you won't understand what that really means to remove your identity from you.
Yeah. That is, I mean, there's so much that we could probably get into with just the native culture and what's gone over the history of it. I mean, maybe we have you back on and just go over that.
But
so jumping all around in Montana, mm-hmm. and where did you settle down?
So all over Montana, bouncing around. And then my dad got a job in Las Vegas. Cool. Working Flight for Life. So we moved to Vegas.
So he ended up living the dream.
He did. Good for him. Yeah. So when we moved to Vegas, it was just a really cool, another experience that really shaped me as a man and as a kid.
I could imagine.
Moving forward, I have this silly nickname, the Ghetto Vaquero, because we moved to East Las Vegas. Okay. My street was, it was kind of like middle class-ish, mm-hmm. but, you know, like the hoods around. Like, it's hard to explain. People haven't been to Vegas, especially my side of town. They're like, because the way it was growing that time we moved in the 90s, we mm-hmm. my dad bought a newer house, you know, a new house, you know, we had a brand new house, but it was like still kind of in this weird area. But it was really cool because just on my street alone, we had so much diversity. And, you know, we had like a black family that had just like moved from North Las Vegas, like straight out of the ghetto to, you know, a nice house. Mm-hmm. We had I call them rednecks, but they're not. They're from Boston, and they're just like the most rednecky, greasy white kids I've ever met in my life. Really cool family, you know, blue collar. Yep. Everyone on my street and everyone in that area was very like blue collar people, you know, or worked in the industry because it's Vegas, so they all work, mm-hmm. you know, in some kind of industry at the service stuff and the casinos. But it was just cool because that really shaped me, because I was also around like gangs, and I had a very diverse upbringing in that.
I can imagine.
You know, being a kid in Montana in the 80s and early 90s, it was like the things my parents went through, you know, a white guy walking around with a brown lady and, you know, my mom's Indian, my mom's very beautiful. So it was like my dad, I remember like my dad was always like getting into stuff. And then vice versa, I would go to the reservations, like some Indians, you know, my dad's white or I'm happy. Like, so it was just always this weird kind of, dynamic with in Montana that, didn't quite fit in, or find a group you fit in with, you know. And I was a kid, so I didn't, you know, yeah. I didn't see all this. So Vegas was cool because it was so diverse.
Oh,
you know, there was
very.
Black, white, Asian, it was everybody. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, started playing sports and doing martial arts and those things, and all of that really helped me just mold me, stay on track, because of like how violent and the things I was exposed to in Montana. Like I said, or excuse me, in Vegas, lots of gangs.
Yep.
Especially where I live, we had a gang that kind of controlled our whole area. So, you know, people who didn't grow up that way don't quite understand, but it's like, it doesn't matter what color you are, man. Like when you walk to school in high school, when you're 15, 16 years old, like it's that you get fucked with, you know, and they mess with you, and they, you know, it's a very like weird dynamic of playing politics of like, how do I just be me in this? I just want to play sports and be good.
I just want to be a kid.
I just want to be a kid, you know? So I kind of learned how to navigate some of that early. But I also got this really cool, I would say like a lot of my swag and the way I feel about life and the way I approach things comes from kind of like my upbringing of being this, like all my idols and heroes when I was really young were all these like salty, badass cowboys,
okay.
You know, and then, or like, and when I say cowboys, I don't think people also misconstrue, like think of like white. It's like, no, I'm talking like Indians, like badass, like white dude, cowboys, Indian, like just cowboys, man. And that was like my favorite thing, you know. It was like, that was all my heroes were these dope ass, my uncles, my grandfather, like all that. And then I moved to Vegas and I'm around where now my heroes start to, they're still cowboys. Like, I still have that as a kid. But now I'm looking at, like, you know, I'm influenced by, like, the other guys, the football players and the wrestlers and my, like my karate instructors and stuff like that. So I'm more influenced on, like, a city level. So I think that upbringing gave me a pretty healthy balance to be able to move forward with life, you know. And I was able to take a lot of those life skills, especially as I move into military later on, of growing up that way in Montana and then also having that, like, kind of street smarts and dealing with
a little bit of it all.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's pretty, as for a kid, I mean, it's,
you know, we, at least us as a family now and having children, I mean, we want our kids to be exposed to as much different experiences, cultures. I mean, it sounds like you checked almost every
frame. Yeah, it was cool, man. I mean, you know, just like when you say cultures, I mean, you know, 1 week, you know, I could have been eating, like, down at my buddy Dietrich's house and his mom made, like, some, like, fried chicken and like, collard greens or something, and the stuff I never had. I'm like, what is this? This is cool. You know, like, soul food. And they're like, you don't know about soul food? And then,
like, and like, oxtail?
Yeah, exactly. Then, you know, the next family over, they're, like, Mexican. So, like, your mom's, like, give you stuff, whatever. And same, my mom, like fried bread for everybody. And it was just a really cool, like, experience to see, like, the moms and the community showing that diversity with through food and culture and just
I feel like
what we're doing. So
that's how it was, though. Like, you know, I feel like for a lot of people, I mean, when I grew up in Chino, everybody played with everybody. I mean, like, I remember looking back as a kid, like, all the parents, I remember parents all would be out talking. I mean, it's not like that. I mean, I'm sure there's still communities and things, but, like, I feel like it's changed so much. Now everybody's just so secluded in their homes and there's no, like,
your phone, dude. You don't
ask what by the neighbor, you know, because you did something stupid and then they bring you home, you know. And I was like, oh, I whooped your kid's ass. They're like, all right, you know, like, those days are so far gone as far as, like, you know, kids just running and coming. We try to keep it as much like that. Yeah. Like, we want to open door
well,
for.
Well, I say, you know, that saying when everyone's like, it takes a village to raise a child, that saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we should say it a little different. And it's like, everyone needs a village. You need to belong to a village. And if you don't belong to a village, it's really hard to navigate all these situations when you're growing, because the way villages work, regardless of, you know, you can point on the globe, wherever it is, whatever era, it was like we all came together to raise our kids to live functional. So, like, if I'm the blacksmith, it's like, yeah, I'm gonna fix and do everything a blacksmith does. But at the same time, it's like, well, you're the hunter. Like, yeah, he's training guys to take him out and go hunting. But, like, I have to help you fix everything and do this. And then, you know, your kids are, you're taking my kids. I got your kids for the day. It's like all these things. And everyone in this village is really putting in each other. It's not just the kids. It's about each other. And I think, like, most days in communities and society, we've gotten so far away from that.
Oh,
people don't even know who their neighbor is. You know, like, you live on the street and there's five houses on your cul-de-sac, but you don't know any, you don't know them. It's hard because people are weird. They're standoffish now. Like, you know, everything's so scary. And it wasn't like we didn't have pedophiles and weirdness in the 80s and 90s. No. It was just, it was more like authority stuff, right? And from the way we raise our children, anybody that we're around, like, consistently, that, like, we're going to be, that's my friend or around my kids, we call them their aunt, uncle, or tia, you know, tia, tio, because my kids know that, because, like, I want you to be able to correct them. Like, if my daughter's doing something she's not supposed to do, or my son's saying something, like, hey, you tell him to do something, he don't say nothing, I want you to be like, yes, sir. Like, he needs to be respectful to adults and do that. And I think that we've gotten so far away from that, because that's how I was raised, you know, like, even, like, being kind of in that kind of weird ghetto environment, like, it was still very respectful to adults. And you looked at other adults for guidance at times, you know, if your parents weren't there and they're immediately there. And I think that's gone away. And now it's like kids are just super disrespectful to even, one, their parents. So they're not going to respect other adults or other authority figures. Mm-hmm. But it goes back to that circle of, like, if we all need somebody, you know, we all need to be doing things together. It's why I like, you know, boys want to be boys and hang out and do things together, like, whether it's go hunting trip or fishing trip or whatever. Like, we need those. Women need to be able to have those circles with their women, and they can, like, you know.
My wife's big on that. She's just, she knows, you know, we've been together for so long now. She'll know. She's like, you need to.
Oh, dude, my wife does all the time. She's like,
you need to go. Go do your thing. And you know, and she likes it because she gets the girl time with the kids. And, yeah. You know, they always talk about it. I'm like, what do you guys, I ask the kids, I'm like, what do y'all do when I'm gone? Like, we stay up late and eat candy and chocolate. We get to sleep in bed with mom. And so it's like, I'm like, you little shit. So they all love it. Yeah, so it's like this little reset. But yeah, it's good to have that camaraderie. I wish it was like how it was when we grew up because now it's like, fuck, man, you don't know. I have kids that live behind me, these two younger, I want to say kids. They look like they're in their teenagers, but I don't know if their parents bought them a house or not. I've tried so many times to like hey, you want some? And the worst part is, where my beehive is, and like I stand on my back, I walk out my back door, and you know I have my rose garden. And the people that owned the house before them, were very old, and it must have been a spare bedroom. The windows were never, the blinds were just shut. It's like, dude, I never had. Now this kid lives in this room, and he'll just be dressing, and I'm staring at my bees, and I'll look up, and he's like damn near naked, and I'm like. Like, I wave all awkward. Like, what do you do when you make eye contact with somebody? But, like, I've tried to, like, hey, you want some honey? Like, hey, there's a beehive right here. I'm not staring at you. But these kids are just, I mean, they look at me and they just, like, they'll come up and close the blinds. And I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, here we go. Like, bro, we've been here for a long time. Like, I'm not, and you know, and so it's one of those cases where I've tried, like, hey, you want some bread? Like, you want some honey? And they're just, absolutely not.
I don't know, man. I mean, obviously, not to go to a different thing, but like the way society is and the way people grow up now with technology and phones and all these just different distractions, you know? And I really, I think that time period, like high school, is influential for me, but very uninfluential. Like, I'm not friends with one person from high school. I don't remember anything other than, like, because I was so into martial arts, I remember a lot of that. But I do, most of it that was influential was just, like, the culture, the people, that kind of, like, that spirit of, like, all these kids playing outside, and we're all friends, and we all did these things together. And I just don't see, like, packs of kids playing and do that stuff anymore. Like, so
all the bikes in the front yard. Yeah, dude. Like, what happened to those?
Oh, dude, we used to be, like, 30 deep on, like, 12 bikes.
Yeah.
And just, like, go across town, play basketball somewhere.
Dude, everybody's got a kid on the back pegs. Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, that's how it was. But I wish we could rewind and show, because, like, we always will do, like, go down memory lane of old school music and how we grew up, and we'll show the kids things, and they're just like God, I would, and I'm like, it was, you'll never know what it was like, you know, where your parents are cruising downtown, like, go down into the, you know, because I lived right out of the village, you know, that's how your mom would find you.
Yeah,
you'd go right around till they'd see a yard full of bikes, and then they'd go, hey, get your ass home. Like, all right, like, you know, like, hey, Lance's dad needs him home, you know, because dads and the parents are all, that's how they used to find us, was just, you know, and man, I miss those days. But
So I kind of, that, what we're talking about, that feeling, I'm very blessed I was able to take that forward in a lot. So right out of high school, I joined the Army, and I actually joined the National, 1998, I joined the National Guard. And my plan at that time was to do high school to flight school. All my dad's pilots that flew with my dad, or flew for my dad, we're all like Vietnam era, like just these badass, like badass pilots. So I was around all this. I had like two retired CW5s like write my letters and like show me like, hey, you can do high school to flight school. This is the thing. And I was working on this packet. And because I joined the National Guard, there was like two jobs I could pick from. One was an MP, and I was like, one was like a mechanic or MP. I was like, I'll be an MP. I'm not going to be a mechanic, dude. Like, no, I don't care. So it was cool because I got to, like, I didn't go to boot camp yet, but I went to, like, drill every, like, once a month. I learned stuff, you know, like, I was around adults, like, soldiers, you know, guys who were, like, 40, 30, 40, you know, like, from younger to all, you know, and I was a high school kid. Like, I was a senior, you know, this is my summer between my junior and senior years when I did this. So I basically had, like, a full year of high school where I was around a lot of I would say adults is a good term, you know, and I mean like true adults, you know, these soldiers, these guys who were like
older mentors.
Yeah. And because it was MPs, I was around like a lot of like higher patrolmen and police officers that like were, you know, now serve that. And I think that helped me too, to understand that like, it was, I wasn't like some degenerate kid and like a criminal, but the other thing about being an MP, it gave me a chance. I was like, hey man, I've done some bullshit in my life.
I've been here.
I've had some chances from some cops that gave me second chances. And, or even in the court, you know, like juvenile stuff that I got second chances on. So I was like, you know, if I can, maybe this is a cool, I don't know anything. It's like, oh, it's a police. Like, cool. So I did that. And the whole time my plan is to go to continue forward. At the time, I got my girlfriend pregnant that year. So
how old were you?
I was 17. So I was 18 when my daughter was born. And she was born in June of 1999. And then I left for basic, like July 6th or something.
No 99. Kidding.
Yeah. So when I went, and it was more of like, hey, I need to, this was already the plan to join the military, but be on the National Guard side until I got the flight stuff done. But I had so much fun, you know, sounds silly. Like boot camp to me was so fun. It was awesome. You know, I had very influential like drill sergeants and people I was around, and I was like, dude, I just want to do this full time. Like, this is like, I'm not, what am I going to do? You know, I started thinking about it. I was like, I got a kid, man. Like, I need to like make money, like have a job. I was working at Costco, dude. I was working at like the meat. I cleaned the meat department at Costco.
Oh,
yeah, it's fun, dude. With a pressure washer and just, you know,
late taking apart all those machines. Or what?
Yeah, I mean, so you start like as the meat department closes, once all the meat's out, probably like 5 or 6.
Yeah.
I actually got locked in there once. Like they just left and I was like back there cleaning.
Just as a kid. Yeah,
I was like 17. I was just like pressure washing fucking hamburger helper off fucking the side of these machines.
And then you get locked in.
Yeah, they lock me in, dude. And then the alarms go off like the fucking SWAT team's about to attack Costco because the fucking...
You're back there.
Just, yeah, just back there cleaning your headphones in. On, yeah. Yeah, they would have fucking... it was a tape, dude. Definitely, I was going to say it wasn't a Discman then either.
Yeah, right? So you make the... you're kind of having this come to Jesus, like, okay, like, yeah. I'm 17, 18 years old. I'm working at Costco. I joined the National Guard, but, like, I need a full-time...
Yeah, I need a full-time gig, dude. And it was, like, all the things that I had in front of me as a young kid, I was like, man, I don't, you know, like, I did have, like, the fallback of, like, the martial arts thing.
Yeah.
We started out doing Taekwondo and then kind of transition into, you know, like full contact, which then it would transition to like kickboxing.
Yep.
And I had a good like run at that. You know, my sister is the most, my sister is a 6-time world champion. She's in the cover like Sports Illustrated for Kids good in for like her. 1998 or some shit.
That's
like
cool.
Just, yeah. And I mean, so I just looked at all that and was like, man, I don't, you know, and I was also kind of, we still did a lot of outdoor stuff when we moved to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was like, yeah, go hiking at Red Rocks and go climbing and stuff like that. But, like, hunting went away, like, fishing, like, all the things that I would do that, like, I could just access regularly in Montana was gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Army to me was, like, getting back into that kind of stuff.
Okay.
That, and if you asked me what I was going to be when I was, like, 4, I'd have been, like, an Airborne Ranger. And that was just what I wanted. Like, I knew I was going to be in the Army. I was going to be a soldier.
There's a lot of guys that I talk to that I always ask, and they say the same thing. They're like, you know, I knew my whole life I wanted to join the military. And I'm like, damn, like, they were like, I was just destined to be, you know, a Ranger or just a grunt, whatever it was. So it's funny. There's a big percentage of guys that were like, that was.
What I think with that, and I'll say a saying before I go into that too, is today is a good day to die. And that's the saying the warriors say before they go into battle. And I was raised with that saying my entire life. So when we would go do something, my dad would leave the house. So my dad's flying helicopters, you know what I mean? Yeah. And doing like, and stuff was crashed. Like I've been to crash sites with him when I was a kid and like his friends are killed, you know, in crashes and you know, cowboys getting hurt. And I was always around like that gritty and like, like an umbrella of death almost, you know, as a first responder for my dad. And like, just, so that saying, we said it a lot as a family, like, I love you, you know, and what it means is, I think that if you ask me what it meant in certain times in my life, it means different things.
Okay.
What it's supposed to mean, the way I'm interpreting this now, where I'm at in my life, is that and this is what my mother would tell me too, and now I'm there, is I'm right with the Creator, I'm right with my family. If I die today, like, I'm not looking for death, but, like, what are you going to do to me? Like, what can you do to me?
When your number's pulled, it's
if
pulled.
If I'm ready.
Yep.
Like, and I think that warrior mindset is something that, like, when you said a lot of guys have that, I've said that to people and it like resonates and clicks and they're like, oh man, I that was like the first time I heard someone put it into words, mm-hmm. the way I was feeling, even as like a young kid, when I would look at, you know, you watch a movie, you watch like Green Berets or whatever, and you're like, you know, Navy SEALs, and you watch fucking stupid movies. But you know, you just watch a movie and you're like, oh, you know, and you get this like glamorization of war. But I think every kid, you know, men, young boys probably have that, but there's a difference. And what I mean is everyone has a calling. Yep. So those guys who knew they were going to be warriors, I feel like the same way someone knows they're going to be a doctor. Like you're the best brain surgeon in the world because that's what the creator made you for. Mm-hmm. You're like, you're a badass hitter in like A squadron right now because that's what the creator made you for, right? Yep. And I think that sometimes when you follow the wrong path, that is where it does mentally, it's really heavy and the weight is different for you.
You're getting pulled back.
You're getting pulled back and you, right, exactly. Uh-huh. So the guys, to me, in my experience, most of my friends and the men I've talked to that had that more of a warrior mindset from a very young age, they deal with the stresses of war and the stresses of their time in combat a lot differently than a lot of other guys do.
For sure. So National Guard.
Yep. So I'm a National Guard. Sorry.
No, you're good, dude. I just want to just keep following this because, I mean, you have such an incredible story in life. So, you know, you got your first girlfriend pregnant.
Yep.
You have a kid at 18.
Yep.
Joining the National Guard, realizing, okay, this isn't, so you go full time.
Yep. So I get there.
Get where?
To basic training, okay. Whatever, and... towards the end of it, like my last like month there, my drill sergeant started to work with my dad and the recruiters back in Nevada to get me changed from National Guard to active duty status.
Okay.
My dad retired from the National Guard. So he was like the battalion flight surgeon over at Battalion Med.
So he had some pull.
So, and it was easy. I was a private, you know, I was like nothing. So the governor just like, yeah, like. Okay, sign whatever, that. Yeah. The army needs them, whatever. So it's super easy.
And this is 99.
So my technical, when I say 20 years in the army, I have 22 years in the military total. 20 years active duty, January 3rd, 2000 to January 30th, 2020 is my active duty time span in the army.
Yeah. So you're pre-9/11.
Pre-9/11.
So you're, after you do boot camp,
mm-hmm.
where'd you go from there? So obviously at boot camp, did you get the word that you're now active duty? Or
not at boot camp.
Was it until afterward?
I had to go back and then do it. So the cool thing was I was just like everyone else that I went to boot camp with, where like I graduated in November and basically would have went home on like hometown recruiting, Christmas Exodus, whatever. Yeah. And then I reported my duty station January 3rd.
Okay.
So like, I mean, I went back. I didn't have to do anything. I like when I went to MEPS, it was just like, oh, stamp. And they're like, you just went from boot camp. Like, yeah, dude, it was literally just like get stamps from people on a line.
Okay. Yeah.
My first duty station was Fort Hood, Texas.
How was that?
I
mean, but then again, you've had, so I like asking because there's so many guys that are like born and raised in, let's say here in Idaho, middle of nowhere. And then they get stationed in like,
right.
Shreveport or something like some crazy, and it's a complete culture
shock. Yeah,
I mean, I guess you've kind of experienced a lot by this point, so you fit right in.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely had a lot of experiences, you know, and like I said, going back to Vegas really helped me because, you know, I had really good friends of like different walks of life, you know, and it was also the first time when I was telling you about like the kids from Boston, I didn't know white people were different. Meaning like, you know, like I was from, only white people I was around was in Montana were like fucking country, like cowboys, dude, like country kids. Mm-hmm. They all did the same thing. They were just cowboys.
Yep.
And I get to Vegas and I'm like, well, what do you mean? Like, I didn't know that, like, because they're from Boston, they talk different. They acted different. They like, they were different food, different everything. I was like, wow. And it was like those experiences were really cool because later in life I've seen that now, especially, you know, having friends from different parts of the country or whatever, you know. So the Army was really cool because now I'm experiencing other people, you know,
which is very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, there, you go to boot camp, I mean, you see every walk of life.
Yeah.
Every walk of life that we have in this country.
Absolutely.
And you're just like,
yeah.
I mean, some people are like, how are you even here?
Oh, yeah. Some people are like, well, I'll fast forward. We'll get there. But I was a drill sergeant too. So I'll tell you a lot of. Okay, well, you talk about fucking retards.
Okay, so you get your first duty station.
Yeah, yeah.
What was your MO? So you're still
I was an MP. Yep. Okay. So I was able to just basically, again, because I went through MP OSIT, you know, one stop unit training for so basic training, AIT are all together as an MP. I get to Fort Hood, and it was literally like I get there in January, and I, even despite my accomplishments as a kid, athletically, you know, winning world champion and fighting like my whole life, my confidence, I don't want to like say the word self-attrit. I didn't have, like, I didn't think I could do the things that I did end up doing. Okay. So like, if I saw like a Ranger or like, there's no way someone would be like, you're like, if someone could like tell me the future, like, you're going to be a Green Beret, I'd be like, get the fuck out of here, bro. Like, okay, what? Yeah. But I did have this, like, you know, whether it's at boot camp to, you know, my whole career, like, I was always like top everything. I was like the fastest dude, the highest PT score, shot the best. Like, so what happened was, is I just chased being the best soldier I could possibly be. And, and so March, I actually just did this race last month. So I get to Fort Hood, start doing PT, like, oh, this kid's a stud. And then my first sergeant was a little Mexican dude who runs marathons. I was like, hey, there's this race called the Baton Death March. A bunch of soldiers always do it. I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. So I did. I did that. I did Baton Death March in 2000. And actually,
how many miles?
26.2. So it's what it is I want to say the year is 1947. No, 1942, April 7th through April 13th, on the island of Bataan. It was like 79 or 75,000 POWs, Filipino and American POWs, were forced to march from the Japanese to a different POW camp on the island of Bataan, and they called it the Death March, and over 18,000 of them were killed. Jesus. So they're basically just like walking like 26 miles a day, and if they fell out, they'd just stab with a bayonet. The villagers, the Filipinos, would like run, like put rice balls together and like try to hand them to the soldiers as they're walking. It's in White Sands Missile Range, and the reason why it's there is because it's very inundated with natives and Mexican Americans, because the New Mexico National Guard, the unit that is now New Mexico National Guard, was there, and they were captured and surrendered on the island of Bataan.
Really?
Yeah. So it was just a really cool experience to, like, when I did it, in, you know, almost 25 years ago in 2000, the, like, the old dudes, the POWs, they're there. They're, like, talking to you.
Shit.
Yeah, it was so cool, man.
I bet
so
you
cool.
didn't even, like, I mean, I'm sure you appreciate it, but, like, looking back now, you're probably like, fuck, I should have asked so many more questions.
So much more. You know, and it was just, it was cool for me, especially that experience with that, because my grandfather was such a, both my grandfathers were such an influential person in my life. Mm-hmm. And my dad's dad lied about his age and joined the war when he was 14. He was 15. So he's 15 years old. He's in the Navy. He drives amphibious assault boats in the South Pacific.
Okay.
And just a fucking badass cowboy, mm-hmm. man, from fucking El Cajon.
And he's so like, you got some veteran blood.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And then my mother's dad, he was a Marine. He was a grunt. He's got a Silver Star in Korea.
Really?
Machine gunner. Yeah, PFC. He assaulted a machine gun.
No shit. Nest.
And, yeah, I'd like the whole write-up. It's really badass.
Damn. Yeah. Just so you were destined.
Yeah, yeah. It was just like, so I was, you know, around that stuff. And so I do the Baton Death March, mm-hmm. and that was kind of like a springboard, a little bit of a springboard for me, because I won. You know, I won.
Really?
So I was like, oh, cool. And everyone's like, you won? I was like, yes, I just ran. You just told me to run, bro.
Yeah, I'm just
just do what Soul Sarge tells me to do, bro.
Don't stop to get to the finish.
So I did that, and then just kept trying to, like, just chase everything I could as a soldier. I ended up going to SRT, which is like the Special Reaction Team, which is like the SWAT team.
Okay.
And this is...
because you're an MP, so you're...
As an MP,
Now you're going to the SWAT side of things.
Correct. So basically, and a lot of people didn't realize this until I think like Iraq kicked off. I was a little more like I was not a garrison MP. I hated patrolling. I didn't want to do that. I was always in the field. And the best way to describe it at the time until Iraq kicked off was like, we're literally like infantry. We just have chicks and trucks. Like, we have a couple girls, and we put everything in trucks, and we drive. It's three-person team, driver, team leader, gunner, in a truck.
Okay.
So we're doing, you know, route reconnaissance, route security, air security. Like, those are all our primary missions. So, you know, you fast forward to the war, that's what everybody ended up doing, was this, like, mm-hmm. convoy security, route clearance, you know, all air security, all these things that we did. So now there's a lot of people who are like, oh, yeah, they were with MPs. Like, oh, yeah, you guys were gunfights all the time and stuff going on. Before, it was like, fucking MP, you know, and I was like, and it was weird because I was like, okay, like, I don't care. I like what I do. You know, I'm in the field all the time. Like, oh. We were attached to my platoon, was attached to 4th ID. So, like, we, you know, when they were out to the field, it was 3rd ACR at first. That my platoon was like to work with. We worked with a brigade of 3rd ACR, and then switched 4th ID and 3rd ACR, switched from Carson to Fort Hood, or I can't remember what happened, but it might have been opposite. 4th ID, then 3rd ACR, I think.
So when were you like, okay, it's time for me to shift gears? How did that come out?
Okay, so I went to SRT, this before 9/11. 9/11 kicks off.
Okay.
I was literally, like, when 9/11 happened, I was at E4, and I was NCIC at the East Gate, the Ranzier Gate.
Okay.
And they brought a platoon of Cav Scouts out to me and dumped them off. And I spent, like, 3 days straight, like, no shaving, no sleep, no nothing, just running the gate. And all we had to search every, because Fort Hood was an open post. So we had locked post down 9/11, and it was taking people like 7 hours to get on post, you know? So, like, it was hectic. And then right after that, we deployed as an SRT to support the Marine Fast Team and a bunch of, and like, a, wasn't a J, it was a maritime objective outside of Egypt. So we're on the Mediterranean. What we were basically pulling a lot with the, what the fast team was doing was we were doing like outer cordons, basically support roles for the Marines, for the recon and the SEALs that were assaulting boats out on the Med.
No shit.
So I didn't have this like badass experience. I was around all these badass Navy SEALs and force recon dudes. But what I did have was like, we're pulling out security and we're working with them. And it was like the first time, like, yeah, it was a deployment. It was cool. You know, I didn't get into like a gunfight on that deployment or anything, but definitely sometimes, you know, if you're snooping and pooping and you're moving through stuff and people are, you know, guys did get into some things, so it was a cool experience. And that was kind of my first time being around, like seeing like, there's so much more to the Army and to the military. And you talk to like, especially, and you know, all this, like everything that can be under the special operations umbrella, there's mm-hmm. so many cool jobs and things people do or they need to pull from. So it's like, hey, yeah, send us a platoon of infantry guys and we'll use them or whatever. So that was right after September 11th. I get back and then I get an opportunity to go to another selection. There's like, go to the selection, they need MPs. I didn't know what it was for. What it ended up being for was a PSD element under, so I ended up moving. And I get stationed at Fort McPherson, Georgia, which is in downtown Atlanta. So I...
Well, that's a culture shock.
Yeah, it was a culture shock.
Sure.
That time was amazing because I was just doing, you know, I was working for one guy and that was my job. And I rode motorcycles then. And all I did was like ride. And I had some of the coolest, like, and I'm still friends with them to this day. You know, like these OG dudes who are like in their 30s and 40s, and I'm like 22, 21. And I mean, we would just like, if you came to Atlanta and like between like 2002 to like 2004, like when I lived there, it was like, if you saw dudes riding wheelies and being crazy, and it was me and my boys. It was like a crew of like 40 of us, and we'd race for money. It was so much fun. And I lived in this mm-hmm. big city, and the only thing I wanted to do was ride, you know, and it was, I learned a lot. I just learned a lot of life stuff from these older guys, you know, and
they're all vets too. Or
no. Some of them were veterans. Okay. Some of them were active duty guys. Some were veterans. Most of them were civilians.
Okay.
So, you know, some of them were criminals, some were, it was just like a cool, like, back to, you know,
a family camaraderie.
Yeah, yeah. I had a lot of that, you know, because I was on this weird post where it wasn't a lot of soldiers, it wasn't a lot of that, you know, so I was
What the hell were you doing out there?
Just PSD stuff.
I know, but like, just, you had one, you said you worked for one guy.
Yeah, I worked for a Forest Comm commander. So, like, yeah, so I would like go on trips, take him on trips, and then we also work, we also serve all the dignitaries, like senators, we get OPCON and TACON out to all over the place to get farmed out as like a element that does PSD.
So you're just doing their personal security. Yep. I mean, they're traveling abroad, or is it all just here in the States?
Both.
So you're still going on like these little mini deployments in like week, two,
week or two, a couple of days.
I mean, that had to have been pretty fun.
It was. And I was on the, I was on like the advanced team.
Okay.
So like I'd go set up, go do like, I don't know if you're supposed to say certain words. Like I'd go do all like the SDRs and do all the routes and get everything set up.
Okay.
Or like if you were the PSO.
And you, this is Iraq or where?
This
where?
Is a lot of places. So we would do, I've been to like Egypt, Turkey, everywhere, Europe. You can think of all the Europe stuff. A lot of stateside things. Iraq, Afghanistan. Iraq and Afghanistan is easiest because you're just flying in.
Yeah.
And like, if we're going to go talk to your commander, it's like your platoon like provides all everything. So I'm just like, yeah, I just walk with the boss, or like I fly in like a day early and it's like, oh, this is where we're going. This is that, you know, it was harder when you go to like a city. So like if the boss was going to like a different, like to say he was going, and it could have been an easy trip, like down to Fort Benning.
Okay.
We have to drive them. We got to do like check all the routes. There's like advance cars. There's this. There's like, so it was like, there's a lot going on.
I drove for the 1st Marine Division General for a while. And I mean, fuck, they go to these events and we have to go route recon. And you're just like,
Well, so it was like that. And then I was also had to do very like army stuff where like dress blues, white gloves, like open the door, like just open the door at like his dinner parties. Really cool. I mean, his wife, they took care of him, and they bought me like Christmas presents and stuff.
They're
like,
cool when you meet them on a personal level because you spend so much time with them.
And then I ended up more being working with his wife more than him.
Okay.
Just kind of how it worked out. I wasn't, the PSOs were always, that's the personal security officer was always like a warrant officer, like directly assigned. And then the NCOs and the soldiers, we did, you know, driving and security elements and things. So it was cool. I mean, like I said, it gave me a perspective of, you know, everyone's a person. And a lot of the, as I continue the story, a lot of senior leaders in the military, the ones that just remember what it was like to be a team, you know, not to say team guy, but what it was like when they were a brand new lieutenant or a young guy and like to do these things. Because all they hear is everyone's just stroking their ego and telling them everything they want to hear. And every officer they talk to is just saying the right shit so they can get promoted. No one tells them truth on the ground. No one talks to them like a fucking friend or a person.
100%.
So when I talk to them, like I learned that from Mrs. Ellis and General Ellis, because like I would just, hey, how you doing today, sir? Learn about him.
Human.
Learn about him, his kids, his wife. Like, and because all his conversations, and I knew in the vehicle or he's going to a meeting, this dude's going to literally spend the next 8 hours just fucking absorbing information and being told bullshit. So let's not talk about army shit or any dumb shit. Let's just like talk about.
Let's be humans.
Yeah. Like basketball, football, whatever he's into and what things I'm in. And you find that commonality. So I learned that. And that really helped me in the future, especially as a Green Beret, to like take that mentality. Like, dude,
I mean, you're spot on with that because I'm the same way. Especially, I mean, you're in the guiding world too. And I mean, dude, I've dealt with clients that are, I mean, you can't even fathom the wealth that they have. And I've always been like, I've always just treated everybody as if they were one of my friends. Yeah. And, you know, and like I've not obviously in the military, because when I was, you know, driving for the general and working up at the division, all that stuff, you obviously have that respect
and
the rank and everything. But like, I would, how's it going? How was it, sir? Like, what, you know, and they would talk and open up to you.
Yeah.
And then obviously when you get to your point, and then it's almost that flip switch. You get out, open the door, and you're back to it with that respect thing. And I learned that as a young Marine as well. Like these people, everybody bows down to them because they're either their rank, their wealth, whatever it is. They're never talked to as a normal friend or person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll have clients that are worth umpteen million. And, dude, I'm talking shit. And I've just met this dude and, like, you know, and chewing their ass, you know, talking to them as a person. And I've always noticed that people will open up more. You become friends much quicker when you just treat the same person with respect. Absolutely. And I mean, that's one of those things that, I mean, not a lot of people can figure out. They always, yes or no. And they have this almost like so robotic, and they have, they're so worried about offending somebody. I'm like, I don't give a fuck. Like, this dude puts his pants on the same way I do. Why? Just because he's, you know, obviously I have the respect if they've done something much longer, or they're a master at that trade or whatever, but like, he puts his pants on the same way I do. They bleed, they bleed like I do. And that's how, if like, you know, I've learned that you just treat everybody like, man, like, come on in, and you'll see there's so much more of a common ground. You can relate to these people. They open up much more. I mean, it's one of those skills that when you learn at an early age,
it gets you so,
it opens up so many doors, because those people will remember you.
Absolutely.
Because it was like, man, that guy, I had to, I mean, we'd be driving for hours, and you know how it is. You got a general in the back, and then they just,
no one's talking.
Just sit there. I can't. Like, me neither. And then you can't play music, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, so I'd be like, sir, what's going on? You know, and just start that conversation. And it's just, before you know it, like, you learn about their families. They're introducing you to their wife and kids. Yep. And yeah, so it's a skill that, I mean, when you, that you could learn, or just realize, like, hey, I'm going to have a conversation with this guy, even though we're not on the same level.
And well, I also looked at it from like the tactical perspective of like, hey man, I understand you're the general and like I'm in charge of protecting you, but there's like six of us out here and you're one of the six, dog. So like, if some shit pops off, like, listen, I'm handing you some shit or like you might be carrying me or vice versa, or this truck is blown up or whatever. So I think like there's that. And if you bring them back, their mind is not thinking like strategic, and they're he's got a brief POTUS, you know, he's got some crazy thing he's doing in the sec def or whatever. And you bring it back to like, hey, when you're doing the route and you're talking about it, you're like, all right, sir, hey, if something happens, we're doing, this is where this is at, this is where this is at, grab that bag, grab the, like, and they're like, they feel like they did, like, they're operational again. And just give them a little bit of
things. It feels good for them too.
Yeah, so I think there's also an importance to that, because like tactically, like, you don't want your, even if you're working with clients, like, you don't want them so far removed to what you guys are doing, you know, doing executive protection, that they have zero idea what's going on. Yep. They need to be able to like receive a little bit of, like, hey, it's time.
It's go time.
We need to go.
We gotta get the fuck off the decks.
You know, because it's hard to do rehearsals with executives and do those things. You know, so, but yeah. So that was a good. Like I said, it was a cool experience there. I also did, you know, the normal stuff we had to do, the color guard and blah blah. You know, just the normal. I was in the Army. You know, so I'm playing a game.
Yep.
What was I doing then? I did get some cool experiences. I went to. It was right when like the Fight House at Fort Benning kind of opened up.
What's the Fight House?
It was like when the Army started like the Modern Army Combatives program.
Okay.
So it was a bloodbath, dude. It was just like a bunch of Rangers that like were told to run this Fight House at Fort Benning and train the Army to fight. And it would just beat the fuck out of each other. Yeah, that's all we did. Mm-hmm. So I got to go to Benning a lot for training. All the ranges and stuff we went on, you know, we you know.
And you're not a Ranger at this point?
No, I'm not a Ranger at all.
Okay.
But
you're doing a lot of work with them.
No, I haven't done any like anything with Rangers at all. And nothing like in special operations, special anything super cool, you know, like but I would fight at the Fight House with a lot of them.
Okay.
You know, they'd come to the Fight House or where teach, or they'd come and teach stuff or whatever when I'd go be able to go down there and train, and then going through the different schools that were down there. And then I re-enlisted to go back to Fort Hood. And I think it was more of just like why I was like familiar. It's like I enjoyed Texas.
Yep.
At the time, the really important things to me was like motorcycles. I love riding motorcycles. It was always hot there. It was like cool. And I had a great time like riding from all over, you know, Austin and just being everywhere in Texas. I was like, yeah, it's cool. And the war is going on. So I was like, well, I know I'm deploying. So I was just looking at that lens of like, hey, when I'm not deployed for a year in Iraq, then like, I still have a year or, you know, a couple months or whatever to enjoy, you know, have fun in Texas, you know. And that's just kind of what I looked at. So I get to Texas. I get back to Texas. And this time I'm a sergeant. So I was E5 promotable. I was just waiting on, like, my points to make staff sergeant.
Yep.
And I was a squad leader. We deployed to Iraq. So I did 05 to 06, November 05, November 06 in Iraq.
Where at?
We're just north of Warhorse between, Bakuba and Udame.
Okay.
And I patrolled, basically everything from like north of Warhorse all the way up into Udame off Route Cheyenne.
How was that?
Area. It wasn't super hard deployment, I would say. What I mean by super hard was there was a lot of guys I think like we all like weigh our trauma. There was a lot of people in that time in units that were just getting hammered, you know.
Sure.
05 and 06 was a rough year, you know. So it wasn't that bad comparably, but it was the first time where I really started to understand leadership and what I needed to do, what I needed to provide, my warrior mindset, my aggressiveness needed to be in everyone that's around me or under me if we're going to make it out of this fucking thing.
Okay.
And I had a kid get killed in another platoon, but he was roommates with one of my gunners. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things where I was like, you know, I was like 25, man. Like, how do me as like a 25-year-old man take this like 18-year-old kid and motivate him enough to get back in the gun and do exactly what his buddy just got his fucking head blown off doing?
Right.
So it was like, wow, like, you know, looking at it from that perspective. Also, because I want to be the best I can possibly be, I'm still, you know, really trying to focus on making sure I'm doing everything's right, like following, you know, troop leading procedures and PCIs and PCCs and like doing all these things, the small details that really count when shit hits the fan, like
absolutely
having all these things done.
And then learning how to be a leader as far as keeping morale up,
yeah,
leading guys in a war zone. I mean,
absolutely.
Don't you love the military? How they just toss you into it,
dude. I mean, I don't think enough veterans, war veterans from just you name the era, and civilians understand what you're asking, like teenagers to do.
No, they don't.
And it's like it's heavy, bro. Because you're like, wait, what? Like, so you're talking about my grandfather was 15 years old, mm-hmm. you know? And it's like, well, okay, so there's that type of guys, but it's also like specialist fucking Monaco has to get back in the gun and he's 18 years old, dude. Mm-hmm. And like his best friend just got his fucking head blown off.
Yeah.
So, or you're like zipping up body bags of like, you might not know those soldiers. You might like roll up on
you're
an ambush.
You're still seeing it. You're still smelling it. Yeah. You got to touch all, it. I mean, and that's, everything. That shit doesn't leave you, especially as a kid, you know?
Yeah.
And they don't prep you for that.
Yeah. So
we see war is hell, but I mean, you know, we know what we're getting. I don't think anybody actually knew what, especially the early era guys, like, oh yeah, I'm going to join the military, go to war. Like, you have no idea what you're even with that mindset. And I'm sure you know you can agree with you. You come from a line of history of veterans. You still didn't have a fucking clue what you were getting yourself into. I mean, you knew what the Army was about. You knew kind of what the military was about, but like until you get to deployed, and I mean, even I have buddies that were 17, 18 years old when they joined, and they had to go do humanitarian cleanup, and they were digging bodies out of sludge for months, and they're talking about how they're holding their hand, and the meat's just coming off their arm because these people are so decayed, and they're technically teenagers still doing this, and it's like, all right, cool, we'll fly you back home, and then you know, like, then it's just, I mean, it's the military, you know, and so it's crazy because you never until you your boots on the ground. I mean, imagine a kid in a fucking war machine in a tank, like, as a gunner, and you're fresh out, and you're, especially when the war kicked off. Your guys were finishing their school, learning, and they weren't even going to the fleet. They were just getting issued their gear and straight overseas.
Yeah, man.
I mean, it was wild for a while.
Yeah, and that whole, like I said, I mean, I think there's just not enough credit. And I wasn't that young. I was 25, being a squad leader.
It's still young.
It's really young. But I feel like, you know, when you're looking at when I look back at like my team leaders, they were probably all like 22, 23, maybe 21, 22. And I am what we call, what would they call this in that area was the sheriff. So like when you're rolling through and it was just like a, you know, like plain text, like single channel plain text frequency on the radio. Yeah. Like when you roll through and you got hit, like you just get on, you're requesting the sheriff to like come to your stuff. So we would come. We were basically driving into gunfights and driving into IEDs and stuff. And that was like, that was tough because we were, I wouldn't say tough. It was tough mentally on the guys on my squad because again, like let's say you're a platoon, you're Marines, you guys are out doing something, whether you're patrolling on foot or you're driving vehicles and you get hit with an IED or something, we come assist you.
So you guys,
all they see is like, they're just loading dudes on fucking helicopters and like help and like, just seeing like, dude, just, you know, dead kids and fucked up, you know, blown up and this and that. And I think like that was like kind of heavy because dudes were like,
sure,
you know, and that time in Iraq, no other deployment have I been on that I was more worried about I was going to die than that one. And the reason why was because the IEDs were so prevalent. And all we did was drive around in fucking trucks. So I'm like,
were,
and
they, it, were they armored at least, or were you in soft?
We started out with like old school 1025s that had like plated. We were like welding.
What's a 1025?
A 1025 is like the, I want to say a 1025 doesn't have a winch, and a 1026 has a winch, if I remember correctly. Okay. But it's just their soft skin MP, like hatchback Humvee back in the day. The original, like kind of the one with the hatch on the back and the gun,
slope,
the turret.
The sloped rear.
The turret. Okay. That was 1025 and 1026s, and we just were like
bolting armor
and shit on.
There's so many stories. I mean, we had a guy that was in the invasion, and they were like, "Oh, putting sandbags in their feet because they thought that was going to help." So you guys were pretty much acting as just a quick reaction force.
A lot of it, yeah. So we were patrolling the area, like we were basically a lot like cops that rolled around like heavy guns, like three trucks deep, and anybody that came into our area, we would support. Or we would if there was just trucks driving through the middle of the desert, we'd fucking roll on, do like a vehicle interdiction and be like, "What the fuck are you? Who are you?" And sometimes there's farmers. Sometimes we get weapons, like whatever, right? Yeah. So we were basically just like patrolling this area, and our main focus was Route Cheyenne to make sure that was clear. So a lot of times we would just set up OPs in the desert at night when we weren't doing anything just watch and just see if, you know, anybody moves in. And then we also did, we work a lot with, on the camp I was on, we had a company of Marine infantry, a company of Cav Scouts, and then my MP company. And we would augment the Marines a lot because we'd take their snipers out. So they'd just jump in our trucks, like on patrol, and just like jump out and man jams and shit, dump them somewhere. We're still able to bait and stuff then, so we'd like throw out deck cord and like sit on it and
watch them. Yeah,
we had a oil refinery that was like a one way in, one way out, and that was really bad area to go down and patrol. And so we like to keep the Marines in there, and then because it was like very green zone too, so it's really easy for guys to just get up on the road, dig, and blow stuff up. We Cav Scouts lost a couple people, trying to get to that oil refinery and stuff. I remember that. But it was the thing that I did during that deployment, which I think really helped, was we had Friday night fights on the camp, and I boxed every Friday night.
They don't do that shit anymore.
We beat the fuck out of each other every Friday night, and I had this rep. I was the 185 champ for like a year, dude. Right. And we just had a cool, like, you know, all the Marines, we'd fight the Marines.
That was like lining them up, I'm sure. Platoon.
Oh, yeah. But it gave me and my squad like so much respect because three guys, all three team leaders in my squad fought. We all trained together. Like, if they didn't get in the ring, like, to physically box. And I think that, like, camaraderie of like just being proud to like watch your like squad just like this dude's just fucking fighting some Marine infantry kid, like fuck it.
And having any Marine around, I mean, you're guaranteed. All you have to do is just say one thing, you're gonna have six of them lined up.
And that year was cool because like my squad had like a cool reputation of like their box. They're like, patrol, like we show up, you're like, "Oh, my boys are here," you know. You call me on the radio, like you see me, be like, "Hey man, can you bring me some chow?" Or we like roll up to you guys, "Are you guys doing all right?" Like, "Dude, we're hungry as fuck." So we're like, "We'll got you, we'll go back."
That's pretty cool.
Load up, you know, chow food. So it was a cool experience to like, you know, it was a good deployment, despite, you know, a lot of those stuff that happened. And like I said, I wasn't like terrified to die. It was just like, dude, I don't want to get, everybody's getting blown up. Like, no one was getting gunfights, getting shot. It was like
toe poppers and
fuck, man. Yeah. So a lot of the injuries I saw were all like just devastating.
For sure.
IEDs.
Scare the fuck out of
FMPs, started coming, or not FMP, the EMPs. Yeah. The EMPs, those, the ones that like fold out with all the brass on the inside.
I'm
just tripping on the name of it right now. It's been so long. But that was like when IEDs really started to get like from just being like bang and blow your chug up to like killing everyone.
Now they're turning armored vehicles. I remember when those came out. What the hell are they called?
I think it's EMP.
I thought the EMP was the one where it takes out all your electronics. You're describing it. They put a steel plate in front of this, a charge. And when the force pretty much turns this thing into a copper liquid.
Yep. So it's basically like, it's like a cone.
A cone. And then when they were hitting vehicles, it was pulling everything out.
It sucks it all out the other side.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when those were first coming out, we would go and we'd see some of these vehicles that got hit. I mean,
yeah.
The way that metal, I'll never forget this, and I don't even know how to, if anybody can even explain it unless you saw it. The way that the armor on vehicles, when they get hit, it looks like if you took that door and made it out of butter and it was really soft, or like when you were a kid and you'd find,
you
that,
mold
perfect,
it.
When you find that perfect mud and you throw a rock in it and it just, and then it stays in, the mud stays in how it explodes. That's what it was doing to the metal.
Yep.
Like these thick ass armored doors, and it looked like butter, how it just melted open, and then you could see how everything was sucked out the other side. I mean, it was scary as fuck watching that shit.
That was the reason why I think it was hard for like myself and my squad, because we did lose, we lost one kid. Joseph Graves was killed that deployment, and then another by an IED, complex ambush with an IED, initiated by an IED.
So how was that? I mean, losing your first guy.
He wasn't mine. He was in a different platoon.
And this is one of your buddies. You,
that was my gunner, one of my gunners, Specialist Monaco. It was his roommate.
Okay.
So we, like, roommate also, we, like, we, they lived in, like, there was, like, a bunch of the gunners, and then we had, we, I'm trying to remember how it was set up, but they also lived in the same hooch, too. So they were roommates at Fort Hood. And then when they deployed, they were also like, well, yeah, and we were like, yeah, you guys can be roommates. So they had, like, the four guys in that hooch, he was in there. So he had to like help his team leader like pack his stuff up, and
it's the worst.
So like the hard part for I think for my guys and for me, what was more waiting on that when we had that mission was because we were going to everything. So like, and my objective in that was always to like, yes, first we set security in, then we figure out how can we help you. And most of the time helping you is like, hey man, you get all your guys off this, like they don't need to fucking see it. So, like, if a Bradley's fucking upside down in a fucking crater, like, we're crawling down into that motherfucker to, like, get the dudes out that are in the Bradley instead of, like,
their own guys.
Yeah, so we would try to, like...
So you're absorbing a lot of the trauma, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, well, I think it was, like, just a weird fear because it was, like, you're seeing what's happening to these dudes, you know? And then, like, my guys are just like, fuck, dude. And we're seeing what the IEDs are doing. And then... about towards the tail end of that deployment, another squad got hit with an IED, really, really bad one, like a daisy chain specifically attacking us. So they were on day shift and I was on night shift. So we worked 12 hour shifts. And so 12 to 12. And I mean, I was probably asleep for a few hours and my platoon sergeant bangs on my door and he's like, you got to fucking roll, dude. Like he's like, second squad just got hit. So we roll out. I was really proud of my guys. I remember this moment because we were at the clearing barrels rolling out before QRF, the Marines were even rolling out the gate. And we get out there and the Marines were like right behind us. We, you know, set up security, do all that stuff. And we had to assume their job. Like, okay. So we get them on the aircraft. They, you know, they get medevaced out and everything, but we stayed on shift until the next morning when they find another squad to replace them.
How bad did those guys get hit with a daisy chain?
No one died. They were all life-changing injuries.
Okay.
I think only like one guy actually stayed in the Army.
Really?
The squad leader, Reese. He was a drill sergeant with me at the same time. The rest of them, I think he just took some shrapnel. But everybody else was like lost legs, lost significant body parts, whether it's like kneecaps. I remember distinctively like helping one of the kids. I think Wenzel was the one without the kneecap. And I knew a lot of these kids. They were in my platoon. Mm-hmm. I was like the PT guy, like for my company to help like remedial PT and make sure people were in shape and all that stuff. So some of those kids, there was like two of those kids that were on my remedial PT program. And I was like, you know, I knew them like, well, so that was like my guys seeing that. I think that was like kind of hard on them to see. You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, what happens in war and all these things. But the reality is like what people don't understand is like these are like friend is a hard word to use.
Yeah.
It's like, especially at that time, like you're talking like it's like losing like your brother.
100% it's a brother.
Yeah. So you're like, it's like a family member that these kids are losing or seeing. And even if I never met you from Adam, and like I said, I roll up to you, and I'm a squad leader and you're a squad leader, I'm like, hey, what's going on? And you're like, we're talking, and we're like, hey, push truck up there, that I'm gonna push whatever, we're getting what we need to do tactically done. But I'm looking at you like never met you before. You're just a, you know, E5 Marine, like trying to get your fucking guys, and you just got hit or you did this or whatever. And it literally like just, it's like I know you from, it's like I knew you knew you, you know?
That's a really good point. I mean, you'd cross paths with guys in other units and you'd be like, yo, dude, all right, where are you going? And you'd dab it. Yeah. All right, okay, cool. And I mean, you could have a 5-minute conversation and then you see that guy months later and you're like,
yeah, at the gym or whatever.
You're like, oh, dude, how's your team doing? Yeah. You're good. It's an instant bond. And I think that's what most civilians, when they ask, like, God, like, what's it like? How do you guys, like, my wife, she's, yeah. I mean, I'm sure yours is, sees it too when you get around old buddies. And it's, and I tell people, I have blood don't make you family.
And it's
love and loyalty.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we get in the military. And people are listening, like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? I'm like, dude, it doesn't matter. Army, it doesn't matter what branch. I mean, over there, there's no, I mean, we would talk shit.
Yeah,
and,
yeah of
I
course.
You know, and you have your rivalries and stuff, and it's all fun and games, and especially like you boxing and stuff. We were having football matches that would last 7 hours, and dudes couldn't even fucking walk the next day and go on patrol because they were so beat up. But it's that we're all there for the same reason. At the time, we all thought we were fighting the good fight.
Yeah.
We're all going through all of our own bullshit over there and helping people. Yeah. And you're involved in it in some way or another. And it's like, it's this instant bond. And so it's like, then you start seeing and hearing about the, oh, hey, this unit got hit. They lost four.
Yeah.
Like, fuck, yeah, man. Like, exactly. We were just with them.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's one of those things. And I think that, especially for guys that that have ever deployed, it's a bond that you'll never be able to describe to anybody.
Yeah. Nah, people don't get it.
They'll never understand. And I honestly, in a way, there was for a long time, I felt bad for like civilians. And I'm like, they'll never, because like I've been on sports teams.
Yeah.
I have really, there's nothing unless you go through some serious trauma bonding, but that's the military.
Yeah.
And I mean, that should be the fine print. Like you're going to have a brotherhood from trauma bonding. You're like, what is trauma bonding? And then you join the military, like the whole experience from start to finish. But it's crazy how tight and just the love for each other that you have over there, and you just in passing. I mean, seeing guys in the chow hall, and it's like, you're like, you sit next to them one day and you grab your quick chow, and you saw, and then you see them, and you're like, oh, what's up, man? And you have that instant, or you find out where they're from, and oh, shit, I'm from there. It's crazy of how tight things get really fast overseas, and how the connection that we bond with each other, and it's something that that'll never. I wish somebody can explain or find a way to explain or show somebody how tight it is, and they'll never understand. It's like, especially, I mean, I can't speak for the Army, but like Marines, it's just I meet another Marine, and it's just that instant, and you know that okay, this dude's got my back, 100%.
Yeah,
and so it's
I that was like one of my. A cool thing. I enjoyed having the infantry Marines there. And I mean, it could have just been, you know, Army. It was having the infantry guys was cool because they were like MPs, but by the end of it, even when they were like switching out, cause they only did like 6 months there and they switched out with another infantry company, another set of Marines. And they were like, no, dude, like they were like, introduce me, you know, like I had a gunner, Lacey Fappel, and, she was actually my gunner in my truck. And, I mean, obviously, she was like a 10, right? Because, you know, she was in Iraq and there's like five chicks on camp. But she was pretty, you know, she's pretty like, but she was like a Valley girl from Cali.
So we have to talk about this real quick. So you say she's a 10.
Yeah.
So we joke about like, she's an Iraq 10, but she's a stateside 3.
Like, no, she wasn't a 3. She was like
I didn't say it her, yeah, but like, there's a rating system. When you don't see women, everybody becomes beautiful. Yeah, and so you'd have to like tell yourself, like, okay, what's she going to look like in the States when we get back?
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know if I want to date her.
Yeah, there was a thing. That's a thing where you're like, somebody be like, dude, I saw this chicken. You know, because we go back to like Haditha Dan, I saw this chicken.
She's beautiful.
Like,
she's so hot.
What's she stateside?
Yeah.
You're like, well, maybe like a 4 or 5. Like, all right, I ain't going to walk up 40 flights.
Yeah, I don't need see this.
I know, I'm good.
It was cool because she was like one of the cute girls on camp, you know, and like people, of course, everyone was like, oh, who's that? But she was like surgical with an AT-4, but she shot an AT-4 like with a fucking sniper rifle, dude. Like,
really?
Never in my life. I don't know what it was, like how she would, like, I mean,
just had it.
Oh, dude, it's like legit, like something like you're like, that's like, I remember we're like getting hit with IDF. And I could see the poo, and I was like, I'm binos, and that we're, so I just moved the trucks around this berm, and I was like, had the Mark 19s going and stuff, and Lacey's standing on the top of the truck and because so she could see it, and shot two of them, two fucking eight, and smoked the fuck. So it's like, I mean, just, and even like in training, you know, we'd go out to the desert and like blow shit, and dude, just like, we had like buildings and stuff, we'd go and she'd be like, I can hit this, right? Like, no fucking way. And she, it was cool. So we had, that was the one female I had in my squad. So even she even had a good reputation and like had cool. to like prove herself, you know, and that was cool. And that was kind of the first time, I always had females, you know, I was an MP, but that was kind of the first time that I saw that, like, hey, yeah, they're different from us. Like, there's a lot of things, you know, and not to go down that rabbit hole, but also like, yeah, but like in certain settings or certain capabilities, like in what we were doing at that time, that mission set, like she was fully capable. She mm-hmm. was awesome. She was a great soldier. And then, so we just kind of got known, like you could tell who our squad was because you could see her in the gun with her blonde hair, like hanging out, you know,
and everybody was looking.
Everyone knows. Yeah, exactly. No, exactly.
Is this them?
So I was like, you know, the dad, I was like, what the fuck are you looking at? You know, like, walking, like, that's why I box every week. And I was like, they're like, it's a fucking squad leader. I was like, you want something? You got to fucking let's get in the ring. But no, I just had a great experience. It was really cool. And then while I was deployed, I was DA selected to be a drill sergeant.
Oh,
so,
you were deployed?
Yeah. So I wanted to be a drill sergeant. So basically when we got back from deployment, it was almost every squad leader in my company was a drill sergeant.
Okay.
Almost every single squad leader in my company got picked to be a recruiter or a drill sergeant, or they were a turd and didn't
mm-hmm.
like, but it was literally like if there was, I don't you know what the number of squad leader was. Yeah. If there was 10, it was 8 of us went, you know, to do that. So I get back from Fort Hood, basically just go straight to drill sergeant school. Drill sergeant school is just going to basic training again, basically. And then you just learn to, like, not fuck privates, take their money or hit them, you know. That's basically all they tell you. And you're just going
Which happens.
Because they bring in, like, you'll watch, like, videos, dudes in, like, Leavenworth telling you about having
really?
Sex privates and shit. Yeah, dude. Like, it's rape. They treat it as rape, which is nuts because... They're double standard for like what they do with the military versus what they do with like governments, you know, senators, governors, everyone else.
For
like
sure.
It's fucking like you literally, you know, can be in like a completely consensual, like I'm not saying it's right because you're an authority figure,
100%.
But like Andrew Cuomo, dog, like what? Like there's no difference, you know, that you're a drill sergeant. Like, so it's just literally like, this double standard. It's weird. And people don't understand how much the military is this like.
Breeds it.
UCMJ and what it is, it's all people forcing it. So like if they want to fuck you, they will. If they don't want to fuck you, they won't.
Yeah.
They don't have to.
That's crazy because I knew it was bad in the recruiting world. I mean, there's recruiters that get caught up constantly. Yeah. I mean
same in drill sergeant. We had a couple drill sergeants in my battalion. Or maybe it wasn't my battalion. I know. So you're on the trail for 2 years.
And the trail is like you
would call it on the trail. Yeah. Being a drill sergeant.
Okay.
So you're on there for 2 years straight.
That's rough. That's kind
of, dude, to be honest, man, it was the fun, like my best time in the Army.
Really?
Better than special forces. Like, I'm not going to say better than special forces. More the fun. Reason why I enjoyed it so much was it was the first time in my life I really felt that I could pay it forward.
Okay.
And, because we just came from Iraq, every single drill sergeant that was in my company or that was every drill sergeant was a fucking went to war, dude.
Yeah.
So like, and the thing is
poor kids, they didn't stand a chance.
Well, that and like the reason why it was so my time to get back was like I always wanted to be a drill sergeant. My drill sergeant was so influential in my life, and he was like. You know, if you look at like in the dictionary, if there was pictures for like a soldier, he was like this jacked black dude from Alabama that was just like, he looked like he played fucking he looked like he was like a wide receiver or something. Just like the perfect soldier, like tall, slender, but like jacked.
Which I feel that's how every drill instructor or drill sergeant should be.
For sure.
That's your first impression as like a young kid.
And he was just like tough. And I remember that like. He did everything. And obviously it's different because you're like knowing now it's like, yeah, it wasn't that hard what he did. Mm-hmm. But he did everything with us.
Yeah.
And I really respected that because that's how I trained when I did martial arts. Like if what we're doing, you're doing. They're like punishments. I might smoke you, but like, let's go, bro. Like, I'll do it with you.
Mm-hmm.
Or like to show them certain things or show them leadership traits. And he did a lot of those things and really helped me continue to want to be into the want to be in the Army. And when I say it was my time to pay it forward, it was like I went to war, I went to combat. We had I had these different experiences from the times in Egypt to the, you know, back and forth to Iraq, Afghanistan, just flying with the boss in, you know, and then Iraq, you know, full on a whole year as a squad leader. So the MP Corps, it's also so small that like you will literally these privates that your civilians you're making to soldiers are going to your friends to you will be their platoon sergeant.
Sure.
Like in 2 years, like and it happened, like no bullshit, you will be their fuck they will be in your fucking platoon. You'll be a first sergeant, there'll be fucking 10 of them in your company. So you
want to make sure you're doing the best.
Yeah, you want to like
you wanna, shit's going to work for you.
Yeah, you want to do a good job and the thing I really saw the tangible when I was a drill sergeant, another saying I really like to say is, you know, no one cares what you've done in the past. It's about what you're doing right now. And that saying is like, and that's leadership to me mm-hmm. because, you know, you could have been the best soldier, the best Marine, Medal of Honor winner, the most badass, like, team leader the Marine Corps has ever fucking seen. But if you're just like a shitty first sergeant right now, you know what you are? You're just a shitty first sergeant. Mm-hmm. No, and everyone rides that coattail, especially if someone gets a certain award or they do that. And it's like, no, dude, he fucking sucks. Like he's shitty. Yeah. And it's what would make me mad is like, as I go through my career, like if a dude's fat, like you're a sergeant major and you're fucking fat, like, especially if you're a Green Beret, I'd be like, fuck that dude. Like, I don't even want to talk to, like, I don't anything you have to say to me, like, I don't give a fuck, dog. Like mm-hmm. you're not on my level. You're not,
nope.
You're fat. So I'm like fat racist, dude, or whatever they call it, whatever the word is.
Especially in the military, Army. I was the same way, man. Like we'd see these Marines and it's like, bro, what the, like, what are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, well, especially with like in where physical fitness is a weapon.
100%.
So like if you're, you know, you're preaching all this bullshit, like you want your fucking chalk blocks and drip pans all fucking lined up, but you don't want. So what standard are we meeting here, bro? Mm-hmm. We're obviously not meeting weight and tape fucking height standard and shit.
I mean, that's how it should be. That's how it used to be. I feel now it's, I mean, I've gone back to base now and like, I look at some of these Marines and I'm like, what in the fuck?
Well, I mean,
like,
the society's just hurting, dude. There's no warriors.
No, I think that. I mean, I think we're gonna have another round of it. I've been watching all these young kids. Topic, but there's a lot of young kids that are coming and looking up to it. And these middle American kids, you know, are fuck. I think there's gonna be another generation of us behind us. I know everyone wants to focus on the negative and soft men create hard all that bullshit. But I think there's still a good core group of young.
Yeah, men. I mean, where I live, I'm around a bunch of country ass like badass kids.
That's
man.
What it
like,
is. It's the city kids that are fucked. City kids are they're toast. But these country kids, I mean, they still got a chance. So. So you're a drill instructor. I want to hear some drill sergeant stories because you guys are the most sadistic human beings on the planet. Yeah. I mean, the way that, at least for the Marine side of things, the way that these guys would fuck with us, it's pure genius. I mean, and I've talked about that they should have. Yeah. I don't know about now. It even last a day, but like a reality show of just the pure
I said that when I was a drill sergeant. So, and I'll tell you that. I always would say, if I could have a camera crew follow me around for a week and make a 30-minute episode, I was like, I'd be the number one show in America, but then they'd cancel
immediately.
They'd fucking kick me off the trail. But when everybody saw it. It's the
most fascinating shit. Like,
but back to that, I'll just give you like a tangible something in your mind for people. You know, and what I saw that as a drill sergeant was such a quick cycle.
Yeah.
Because you're there for 2 years. You know, you are... by regulation, each phase you're dictated how long you have to be there. So the first 4 weeks of basic training, and really the first like 8 weeks, because it's your rifle marksmanship, you're doing all these intense things, you're all hands on deck.
You never leave.
Like, you're there 30 minutes before wake up and 30 minutes after lights out by regulation during the first 4 weeks. Then you're doing it again because you need to be there early enough to train your guys to like to shoot well and mm-hmm. qualify and do what they need to do. So it's a lot.
You're married to the troops.
So what happens is it's 2 years. So most the old school way or the kind of the cycle of it was like, as you get longer in the tooth to getting off the trail, the younger guys are doing all of like the more of the stress work and yelling and getting you like, dude, I've been yelling for 2 years.
You
like,
become a senior. So you're more, yeah, so you're the like, good cop now.
So what happens is like, we're on the obstacle course and let's say like, you're the guy, it's raining outside, you're wearing a Gore-Tex jacket. They never even seen a Gore-Tex jacket. So it just looks like a cool, sweet army jacket to them. Uh-huh. And it's pouring rain. You're just standing there with your arms crossed at the fucking one of the obstacles. Just like, hurry up, private, let's fucking go. You're just mad because you're standing there. And then I fucking come running through, like, muddy as fuck, covered in camo on my face. I'm like, let's fucking go. Like, low crawling, yeah, like, having fun and just, like, motivating them and going and going. Who do you think they want to be like?
Exactly.
And that's where I saw that leader, because that was an actual story. Like, no bullshit. We had a senior guy, and that's what he did. And no one fucking respected him. The drill sergeants didn't. The privates didn't. Like, they did what he told them to do, but, like, sure, they didn't want to be him. You know, there's no people telling stories about how they wanted to be like him.
He didn't have that leadership when he came up in it. I guarantee it.
So, being a drill sergeant. All right, so. One of the things I used to do.
What was your favorite?
Okay, so this is my absolute favorite. I wanted to scare the shit out of you when you first got there in some kind of way where you're like, eh. So if you thought you were a tough guy or something, I wanted to know where you were at. So what I would do is we had field week, and field week, a full cycle for us was 220 privates. Usually in the summer, we'd feel like 260. It's a lot, bro.
Kids.
So 220 is standard, but in the summer surges, we'd get 260 or plus, and it was a fuck ton, bro.
And how many drill sergeants? Is there three?
Supposed to be three per platoon, but most of the time it was two.
You have that many kids, the two of you?
Oh. No. Each platoon, there's four platoons in a company. Okay. So you're about 40. You know, each 45, 50, 60 kids. Oh, my God.
I thought you guys, that was one platoon.
No. Okay. So you've got, like, you know, 40 to 60, around for three guys. The problem with the three is, you know, you got CQ out, like, full, you know, 24-hour duties and all the crazy stuff that goes on. But anyway, we do field week, and each day they give you, like, you know, 50, you know, privates or whatever for, like, 4 days until you get everybody. And then, like, so you're only in processing, like, doing the paperwork stuff with, so you're doing shark attack where they get off the bus and you're fucking doing all that shit, right? Trail of Tears with their bags and all that shit. And then you have your platoons, so you're just doing paperwork, you're doing their counseling packets. And what I would do when I was sitting there, I would always read them, and I always found four dudes. I'm holding up number three. Four.
You would have made a great Marine.
So I always found four guys, and my four guys was always four different races of guys from different places that did a lot of the same thing. So when I read your packet, I met you, and I was like, I'm looking at it. I was like, oh, you're from California? And you're like, yes, sir. So I'm like, oh, did you wrestle? I wrestled, played football. I'm like, okay. And I'm looking at this, like, this is your stuff. You actually did this. I'm like, all right. And I'd be like, all right, he's one of them. That big fucking white kid from, with the tattoos from California, he's one. And then I have, like, you know, pulling him, looking. And it's like, hey, this kid played football. This big black dude from fucking North Carolina. I'm like, he's one. And I would just, like, Mexican kid, like some tough little fucking vato motherfucker. I'd be like, what'd you do? He's like, nothing, just on our debt. And he's just like a tough little fucking guy. Like, all right. So what I would do is I would find those four guys. And then I'd make anything that happened in my platoon their fucking responsibility. So I was like, bro, if motherfuckers out of line, like, and I had this joke too, when I'd be CQ, like, it'd progress. Like, when I was on CQ, I would be like, hey, man, I'd be like, hey, privates, sometimes when Joe Wilbur's on CQ, people fall out of the bunk. That's all I got.
So you were letting your guys police their own?
Oh, yeah. I made that, like, the standard. Like, you.
So those were your guide and squad leaders, pretty much what you were picking?
No, not at all.
No?
Nope. These were just fucking dudes I knew that would fight. Dudes I knew that would fight.
No shit.
Yep. Because I needed to play the game of what's going on in my platoon.
Mm-hmm.
How do I know everything that's going on in here? How do I instill this I hate bullies.
Yep.
And I wasn't asking for four bullies. I wanted four guys who had been there, who understand, like, sports and team camaraderie and fighting and that kind of, like, feel, that vibe. I want that country ass kid. Mm-hmm. You know, I want the like a ghetto kid that gets it. Like, and what that does is it allows them to, and I would tell them, like, you're not fucking bullies, but you need to make shit happen. Because sometimes all those little squabbles and shit that drill sergeants don't need to handle, like, what? We're adults, bro. Like, fucking handle that shit. So I'd always look for that, and that really helped out, you know, as we'd go through basic training and do things. Yeah. And I'd also have them do, like, I'd have a duffel bag. And in that duffel bag, if any gear was, like, unsecure, I was like, put in that fucking duffel bag. Because we need to turn it in for CIF.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, my dudes would literally be like, we'd be like, we're walking, and they'd be like, privates with their shit out. And they'd be like, criminal. They'd be like, you know, there's only one thief in the army, right? Everyone's else trying to get their shit back.
Same shit.
So, so they'd be like, this is unsecure. Like, fucking throw it in the bag. Like, just, you know, it was funny, you know, and some of it's probably like, oh. But I did that, and that really kind of, like, for me, every cycle helped give me a couple guys that were like, you know, and sometimes it didn't always work out. Some of that, you know, change guys around or whatever. So that was like in my mind during field week. I'd always read those packets. And then the next thing I would do is when I got my whole platoon, everyone who's going to be assigned to my platoon, male and female.
So you the female and female?
Yeah. So we had females. Yeah, we had a female bay.
How does that work?
It was rough. It was rough. So we also have female drill sergeants. So I was blessed. I had a female battle buddy. I had a female, my senior drill sergeant on my platoon, and then she actually became our senior in the company. She's one of like the highest ranking NCOs in the Army right now. She was up for like Sergeant Major of the Army. I was hoping she would have got it.
So how does this work? Because, you know, when I went to Paris Island, the
female. You guys are completely separate.
You don't even see them until you get to
So ours is everything is exactly the same, except for like when you go into your bay. So like the female drill sergeants are not allowed. So we have changing rooms. So you have to be in like this. So you could walk into the bay. Mm-hmm. No one's allowed to be undressed or anything in the bay. Where like when you look down the set of the bunks and the lockers and everything that's in there, there's like a literally like an L shape to get in room outside the shower room where you change and do everything in. The females and the males, they all have that set up. So if a female walks on the floor, they announce that the female drill sergeant's walking on the floor. They yell at ease and they know it's a female drill sergeant. The male drill sergeants have to be escorted. The male drill sergeants have to be escorted until you get a certain point in the phase. But the same thing, this CLD is like, hey, if male privates go up there to do something to interact, like you're a squad leader and you need to get past information or whatever, they have to yell like male on the floor. Like
that sounds like such a pain in the ass.
It's a pain, but it's also like from what I don't understand is like, I get why the Marine Corps does it. And the Army has like, obviously like, you know, now every females can do anything, but before it was like, you know, infantry, like I get it. It does make some sense though, when you're asking like what the Marine Corps does, they train males and they train females. Then they ask them to live together and cohabitate. So it's like, not everyone's infantry. I mean, not everyone, some people are going to be paperwork and mechanics and they're going to work with females. So if you never like, my whole point is like, well, then why would you, if you have a job where you're supposed to work with
everybody. I never had any crossover from boot camp all the way until I went to division to be the color guard. And that's the only like that, because, you know, I was working up at the flagpole at the White House. And that was my first experience with women. And I was a crusty, wannabe, salty sergeant working with these females for the first time. And like, dude, it was a complete culture shock for me, because how they were talking and treating us, like, it was, blew my mind, right? And then at that time, it was just, I had all these dudes that were hardcore trigger pullers. I mean, most of them had two or three Purple Hearts, and they, same thing. They never, and then we all go up to division, and now we're working with these, like, privates. They're like, and they would us, and it was like,
what the fuck?
And we're chewing ass, and my buddy threw one of them through a door at Marine Corps ball because she was just belligerent, and it was this huge shit show, and like, it's like, that's how we treated our troops. But now you have these women. Yeah. So it's almost a good example. But I mean, I don't know how many times there'd be 70 dudes butt ass naked standing online all at attention. And you're just like, this is the most degrading shit. And we'd stand there for hours.
We did stuff like that, but in like a controlled environment. So we had, during like the first 4 weeks, we'd run shower drills, which is basically like, everybody doesn't know, it's like the gayest thing you can possibly do. You're literally like butt to butt, you know, standing back to, you know, in a line, and it's literally like all the showers are on. You're like 10 seconds in the water, 10 seconds of scrubbing, 10 seconds in the water.
Tell us this, for everybody watching and listening, those shower drills, at least for us, they would have them freezing ass cold.
Oh, yeah. Hot, and cold, fire and ice.
Scalding
fire
hot.
Fire and ice.
And we would just run through. And so you're like, it sucks the wind out of you, then you're melting your skin. Then you just make us do laps in that shit.
I just remember one day I had some awesome drill sergeants, man. One of my best friends, Jerome Easter, he was on the trail with me. And I remember one day we were doing shower drills, and he was up there, and I walk up to the bay, and all I hear from the change room is, I'm like, what the fuck are they saying? And he was like, every time they'd take a step forward to like be the next in line, and like the whole line would go, they would say, pardon my loofah, pardon my loofah, pardon my loofah. So there's like 60 dudes in here butt naked with like their loofahs in their hands. I was like, oh my God, man, you're gonna fucking get in so much trouble. But okay, drill sergeant. So this, this was my favorite thing to do. This is what I did. Is I wanted to scare everyone, right? Okay. So I got all my platoon, and I'd take them up to the male latrine. Go in the latrine, And we have to teach them everything that they do. So, like, teach this how you clean the mirror. This is how you do blah, blah. So I have females, everyone in this fucking latrine. Before they'd go in there, I'd take a Snickers bar, and I'd crush it up a little bit and make it look like a turd, and I'd stick it in the toilet. I'd pour a little Mountain Dew on top, put some toilet paper in there, and just let it sit in there. And then I have my whole platoon in there, and I would, like, hey, this is what you're doing in private, blah, 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 you know, like, talking, and someone talk, you know, I'm going at him, blah, blah. The whole, this is, like, 2 hours in the fucking latrine, right?
Yeah.
So I get to that fucking, dude, and it was hard. I had to, like, hold my shit together and be like, all right, all right. And I'd open up that latrine, and I would just go ape shit. I'd be like, this is fucking disgusting. You do this at home? And I'd reach in and I'd grab that Snickers bar, and I would scream at him. Like,
as you're pointing.
Just fucking, just going, and like with this thing in my hand, and then I'd throw it into the toilet, kick the toilet flush, and then just, I was like, you're fucking, and I would like on my hands, and I'd be like, you're fucking disgusting. And I would leave the latrine and let them sit in there for like 10 minutes by themselves.
And these people are like, yeah. What the yeah, fuck? Like, what the
fuck? And,
this dude's out of control.
Yeah, I had a, I had this kid, called him Radio because he looked like fucking Cuba Gooding Jr. from fucking Radio.
That's another thing. You, drone instructors come up with the, oh, dude, the most best, fascinating
yeah,
best names. Names,
dude. Yeah. We had so many names.
Fascinating names. This
kid, Radio, but he played middle linebacker at University of North Carolina. He's just a jacked black kid, dude.
Uh-huh.
And he was like culture shock. Like, never been around white people before like that. Like,
so that's what a lot of people don't understand. When you join the military, I mean, I remember having kids from, I'm talking the coon ass kids from Louisiana that never even been around white kids before.
Yep.
And then I remember white kids were like, oh, these guys can't swim?
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure.
Like, yeah. And I was like, it's a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing. You're like, no, it's really a thing, bro. Yeah.
Like, you're like, oh, okay.
Pools in the hood, dog.
Yeah, and then my drone instructor, literally before we did swim qual at boot camp, they sat us down and he was like, listen, motherfuckers, like, this isn't racist. And he was a short drone instructor, Sergeant Barnes. I've talked about him on one of the podcasts. I'd love to find him one of these. But he literally sat us down. He's like, it's a culture thing. And I didn't have no idea.
Yeah.
What I grew up on a river, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, swimming, everybody swims.
Yeah.
And he's talking to us, and I'm like, I'll never forget it. We're sitting all Indian style. I mean, I guess crisscross applesauce now, but.
No, Indian style.
They're trying to take that from us. I remember sitting there, and he's talking to us like, all right, this ain't racist. But some of us can't swim. Yeah. And I remember sitting there like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? And he's like, all you dark Marines, he's like, we're going to be in the pool for the next week. And he's like, it's going to suck. And I remember looking at my buddy, he was from Florida. I'm like, black people can't swim? And he's like, no, man, black people can't swim. I'm like.
He's like normal. Like, bro, what do you, no, we can't fucking swim, bro.
I was like, what do you mean? Just black people can't swim? I thought it was just black people couldn't swim. Like,
yeah,
they're just somehow, like, their bodies are built different. I had no idea that there's no pools and hoods.
It's funny that you're saying that because that is the military. Because you're getting, you know, you're like a white kid from Minnesota, never even seen a black kid person except for on TV. Next thing you know, you're like this jack black dude's like screaming at you at boot camp. And then my favorite thing about the Army, though, is you fast forward that and you literally have like a kid who from Minnesota, never seen a black kid in his life, and he's roommates with a black dude from Brooklyn.
Yes.
And now this kid, this white dude, you fast forward now, and there's like two 40-year-old men that are like best friends. He loves fucking Wu-Tang. This dude listens to the fucking country and shit. He goes like fishing and hunting with his buddy from Minnesota.
You,
and like,
you pick
it's
up
so fucking
so
cool.
Many,
it's so fucking cool.
That's why vets are into so much different shit because like, dude, I didn't know what the fuck Wu-Tang was. Like, you know, and then you're getting introduced to so many different cultures and music and food. And then you go home with these dudes on leave. And then now you're at your Mexican buddy's house and his mom's cooking the craziest shit for you. And, you know, you come home and back to the barracks or whatever. And you're just, everyone's talking like, oh, my God. Like, dude, that was one of the coolest parts about the military is being exposed to so many different walks of life. Yeah.
It's my favorite thing about the military because it is America. It is
100%.
All walks of life, all colors, creeds, religions, sexual orientation, like anything you want to, Republican, anything that is dividing right now, conservatives, liberals, whatever you want to call it, gay dude, what, like no one fucking cares, No one cares. And the only time anybody ever cared was when people tried to hide that something from somebody. Then they're like, why don't you tell me you're gay, bro?
Out,
like, we don't care you're gay. Just don't look at me when I'm changing. And then it just becomes a gay joke. You're like, don't fucking look at my dick, faggot. You know, whatever. And it's like,
if more people had that humor and that ability to embrace each other for their differences, like they do, like you're almost forced to in the military.
Have to.
And now, obviously, not to get off the subject, but like now it's not that. Now we're actually, it's good to be different. But the reality is soldiers don't need to be different, bro. Killers need to be trained and all the same and have the same standards and
for sure. But and bring, be the, bring your culture, bring your beliefs. That's
it cool. removes your identity from you and you get to keep small things about who you are that make you good. So it kind of removes like a lot of the bad identity of you and then gives you the identity of being a Marine or being a soldier, something to belong to, a skill set to build off of. And then use your culture and who you are as an American or an immigrant or whatever you are.
That's another thing.
I do have some badass fucking dudes all over the world.
We had immigrants in our platoon that guys were coming here to get, and that's how they were getting their green card. And I'm like, wait, you joined the military to be, and you're not even a U.S. citizen? I'm like, no. Yeah. And
I've had like really cool ceremonies to like, you know, citizenship, like being able to like, go to like citizenship ceremonies, like
some of those are like some of the most proud moments.
Yeah, they're so
like
cool.
I mean, I've been to a couple where it's honestly emotional because you take this guy from Honduras freaking Mexico or wherever they're from, and they want to become an American so bad that they join the military because they're trying to better their family. It's not even the kid, especially Hispanic kids. It's never for themselves. It was always about their family. Yeah. Dude, I get goosebumps talking about because I've worked with so many of them. And they're always the most incredible kids. This dude is willing to put his life on the line to help his family, to join the military. And here I am from upstate New York on the Canadian border. And I'm like, you're what? Like,
well that's...
And it's incredible. Right. And that's what I mean. That's the best part about the military.
That's my America, dude. And that's what, like, what pisses me off about what goes on now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I try to, like, share a lot of that in social media or how I conduct myself because it's like, no, that's my America, bro. Like, I am this mixed race, half-breed kid that had my family's identity removed. But at the same time, the identity of warriors and being a warrior culture and a warrior society and that blood that flows, my fucking ancestors' blood pumps in my body, bro. Like, it's why I was able to do what I did. Yep. So, like, to me, that's so cool. And we are so far removed from highlighting that. Instead, we want, you know, in society in general. And it's like the one thing I always tell people and veterans is, like, do not lose sight of all walks of life. All people from every color, creed, religion, sexual orientation, you name it, came together and you're all the same. Mm-hmm. You're all fucking brothers. You're all this amazing group of people. And we just lost sight of that. You know?
I mean, I remember meeting guys and you can tell, I mean, dude, there were some hardcore dudes that did not like some other dudes.
Yeah.
You're forced.
Yeah.
I mean, within months, I mean,
well, a lot of it's just not knowing. A lot of it's not knowing, right? Because your interactions with something, if you're like a white kid and you don't really have you didn't play football, you didn't play basketball, you're not from the city where you're going to have like, you know, unless you play basketball or football and you're from a city, you might not have a bunch of like homies that are Mexican or black or any other color, right? So what your interactions with black dude is like the motherfucker who walks diagonal across the parking lot at Walmart with his pants sagging and he's like, what, motherfucker? And you're like, of course. And you're just like, right? But the reality is like, bro, that's not every, like even your black hoe would be like, get the fuck out of the street, motherfucker. Like he would be like, fuck you, dude. You know, like, and you just, because they've never seen that interaction. So everything is about your personal experiences and you're just, you're drawing from all of your own personal experiences. Yeah. In today's day and age, social media has made your experiences my experiences versus before it was, no. My experiences are my experiences, and I'm learning how to navigate this in life.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
But now everybody builds their own image of you off of their social, and they think everything's completely different.
Right, or they tell themselves a story based off something they saw somebody do, and now the whole group is this, or the whole thing is that, and it's like, you know? Well, and like, you know.
I don't want to get off topic.
No, me neither.
I want to get to your Green Beret days.